so we looked to what the visual nomenclature of hero worship was in this country, and we settled upon a statue. Originally, it was going to be a full-body statue. It became a bust once we collaborated with Doyle Trakina, who's the sculptor.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we decided to make this bust, we had to figure out where we were going to put it. And when we found the place that we did install it, which was the Prison Ship Martyrs Monument in Fort Greene, Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
that's a monument that honors those who lost their lives during the Revolutionary War. And once we found that location and that empty pillar that existed there, we were like, well, this is kismet. This is now a much bigger and more powerful narrative.
This is The Conversation. It's episode 206 with Jeff Greenspan. He is a Brooklyn-based artist, activist, comedian, and believe it or not, creative director in advertising. So as you can imagine, there is a ton to talk about. This is one of my favorite episodes, definitely in quite a long time, if not ever. I will tell you the reasons for that in a moment. A lot of great projects. There's some stuff you should definitely check out, ideally before you listen to this conversation, but just stay tuned for that. First, I want to tell you that we have a sponsor for this episode. I am excited to tell you, and that sponsor is Artwork Archive. This episode of The Conversation is sponsored by Artwork Archive. Artwork Archive understands that being an artist also means being a business owner, a marketing professional, and an administrator. That's why they created an online tool to help artists get organized and manage all aspects of their career from one platform. Artwork Archive gives you the tools to run your art career with confidence and make a living doing what you love. For a limited time, The Conversation listeners, that's you guys, will receive 20% off when you get started with a free trial at www.artworkarchive.com/theconversation. That's artworkarchive.com/theconversation. Please go and check out Artwork Archive. By supporting them, you are also supporting this podcast. So thank you very much in advance. Okay, so Jeff Greenspan coming up. One thing that I would highly recommend is, at the very least, go check out the images in his gallery at theconversationpod.com. Go to his episode page. Particularly, I would recommend that you go check out this minute plus, just a little over a minute video called The Statue Experiment, which Jeff did, which will blow your mind. Highly recommend you check that out maybe before we talk about it so we don't spoil it for you. There's that. Jeff and his frequent collaborator, Andrew Titer, were also involved in a rogue Edward Snowden bust project, rogue to the extent that they illicitly installed it in a public park in Brooklyn in the dead of night. And we talk all about the genesis, the arc, the installation, and the ensuing events that unfolded in relation to that project. You heard a little bit about in the teaser at the beginning there. So there is a lot to look forward to there. Plus, just breaking down the constant contradiction that is Jeff Greenspan being now an artist slash activist and continuing to be a brand executive, you know, advertising creative director. How is that even possible? So you may get some sense of how that is possible when you listen to this conversation. Before we get there, one more thing. Just want to let you know that I'm in a show that is opening next month. It's January 13th for all those of you in the LA area. I hope you can make it out. I'll tell you more on the back end. January 13th at Eastside International. It's a two-person show with a Chicago artist named Esau McGee. I'll tell you more about that on the back end. Just wanted to give you a heads up. On the back end, I will also share with you, I'll give you a little preview of an online exhibition called A Message from Earth, which artfully honors 40 years of the Voyager spacecrafts hurtling away from Earth. So that's to come as well. Let's get into that conversation with Jeff. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you very much for being here, and I will talk to you more on the back end. Um, Well, I thought we would start. I mean, I know you're in Williamsburg. We'll just say for the listener that you're in Williamsburg. You're in East Williamsburg, just for the record.
Because, I'm in East Williamsburg.
Because you don't want
to say East Williamsburg, so I have street cred.
Right.
Right. You don't want to be known as a Williamsburg by the water person.
No, that's a whole different. Certainly not that.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
I just wanted to mention that for the listeners.
I'm one level down in gentrification.
Right. And we may come back to that at some point, but I thought it would be perfect to encapsulate you with your own about statement. So I'm just going to read it, if you will allow me to, unless you think it would be better if you read it yourself.
I don't have it right in front of me. I'm happy to have you read it.
Okay, yeah.
If you don't mind.
I was going to, so let's do it. I just realized, I wonder if it would be better coming from you, but I'm just going to go ahead and do it myself. So this is on your about page of your website. I'm an NYC-based artist, activist, and comedian. Since I also enjoy eating and having nice stuff, I freelance as a creative director, helping brands talk to people without seeming like jerks. I was BuzzFeed's first chief creative officer, worked closely with Zuck at Facebook to launch Timeline, and was a creative director at BBDO NY. I'm focusing on being happy more than on being right. It's making me miserable. So there's a lot to unpack there, and that's why I thought it was a really good place to start. Because as I was looking at your various bodies of work, from your day job work to your activist and artist work, you know, there's so many, I don't know if contradiction is the right word, but there's a lot of sort of countervailing material, because you're doing commercial work on one hand and you're doing activist work on the other.
Yeah, I think contradiction is the perfect word, because I'm a walking contradiction, as are a lot of people.
Right.
And that's something I grapple with, not just with my professional work, but in like all aspects of my life.
Yeah.
Everything.
Right.
So this is like therapy. Interesting.
Well, okay. In the
I
best
like
of
it.
Moments it,
you know,
it,
like
it will be. In the best of moments it will be.
Maybe for you as well. Maybe for you as well.
We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got into advertising when I was much younger, and I didn't have the same worldview at 24 that I do now at 47.
Yeah.
And so I was blind to a lot of the ugly side of consumerism and commercialism and rampant capitalism. And I'm not a communist or anything like that. Not that that would be bad, but
no,
I just wasn't aware of a lot of things politically or in the business world.
Right.
And as you know, I went through my career, I excelled in it, and I was making more money and had more prestigious jobs and better creative opportunities and larger opportunities. And those two things were growing at the same time. My observations about the world outside, you know, my little corner and my career. And so I got to a point where, you know, it was kind of hard to walk away from the career, because now the irony is I'm in the money that I'm, you know, I'm in the system that I'm higher up in a system that I've also kept enough of a consciousness about myself to kind of observe also from a little bit from the outside, if I was able to. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me clarify something though. Yeah. So one of the pursuits that you, or one of the identities that you have, maybe is a better way to put it, is you're an artist. It sounds to me, just to clarify, that you, once you got out of college, undergrad, you went into advertising as opposed to getting into art.
Right.
So you came into art through the back door as opposed to the front door.
Oh, absolutely. I was never, and I never thought of myself as an artist. I mean, I had gone to, you know, art schools when I was younger, but I had no intention of being an artist. That wasn't my goal.
Why?
I had some artistic
what was
ways
your
about
goal?
Me.
What was your goal?
What?
What was your goal?
My goal when I got into advertising was to get a job and be, I wanted to be, you know, an adult and be in the business world, because I thought that's what being an adult meant, so I could be self-sufficient. And so, so I got into advertising, and I can talk to you about how I got into it. But once I was in it, just back to the contradiction part that you were bringing up, a lot of the work I do is, you know, points the finger at corporate America, which are the same people that actually pay my way when I'm doing creative work.
Yeah.
So there is an element of biting the hand that feeds.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of it, and I'm aware that it looks, not only does it look, but it feels hypocritical.
Right.
And I grapple with that.
Right.
You know? And I've actually talked to a therapist about it, and you know, the guidance I got at the time was, we can only do, you know, what we can do. You know, I'm not a legislator. I'm not a politician. I'm not someone who wants to go out and put my body on the line, maybe for the causes I'm talking about right now. But I have learned through advertising how to manipulate words and images and the media and people's emotions to sell stuff. So I thought maybe I can use those things to sell ideas or points of view that I think deserve more attention. Mm-hmm. And maybe that will inspire someone else who does have the means to actually make a change, maybe more in their own way, that might be more substantial than in my way.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's a cop out, but it helps me sleep a little bit better at night that I'm doing what I can do. And I can also rationalize it by saying, you know, it's because of the money I make from advertising that I can fund these projects, because some of them are quite expensive.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It reminds me of sort of reversing the carbon footprint. You know, there's this thing called, I think it's called TerraPass. I don't know if that was just a California thing or a national thing, where you could buy these chips or what have you, these credits. That was a way of reversing the carbon footprint generally. You know, it was supposed to go to renewable resources and energy and so on. So there's a certain there's a certain aspect of you taking money from the corporation, from the corporate world in advertising, and then sort of paying it back with these activist projects.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it, and that's the way I choose to look at it.
Right.
There's another contradiction in there, and it's an ugly thing to talk about, but you know, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
I sometimes feel like it's self-promotion, and isn't that gross to use issues, political and societal issues, to further your own quote brand. But then again, I can go right back into the cycle and be like, okay, but if my presence grows, then my ability to scale my ideas grow, and I can reach more and more people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to know. I guess you could say this about anyone who's doing anything artistic, and then is also trying to bring light to other issues. Are they using the issue to promote themselves, or are they using themselves to promote the issue? And I don't know if it matters, but I say that because I'm doing it. If I was on the outside listening to this, I'd be like, I don't know, maybe that guy's a jerk. I don't know, and maybe I am. You know, I very well might be a jerk.
Let me ask you this. Having done advertising for so long, you've done it for over 20 years, right? So what, if you think about how the various projects you've been involved in, either individually or collectively, have impacted the culture, do you have only an abstract sense of how they have? Or in some cases, are you able to see the manifestations of the things you've worked on and how they've manifested in the culture?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, in 20 years, another ugly truth, I haven't had that much corporate work produced.
Hmm.
I've had an unusual career in that I've been able to impress a lot of creative directors and hopefully colleagues with my ideas. And those ideas are usually set forth, you know, with a group of other ideas. And I'm glad that my ideas had enough merit to move all the way up to, you know, a client presentation.
Right.
But they were very often not the ones that were picked. And, you know, sometimes I'd like to think it's because the ideas were too challenging or too unexpected. I'm not the only one doing that. There are plenty of creatives in this business, in the advertising industry, who are doing provocative work that's too daring for the client at the time it's presented.
Mm-hmm.
But I just didn't, you know, get a lot of it produced. So I don't think my work has had a huge effect on the culture in advertising at all. Except that I've, you know, as I moved up the ranks, I hired a lot of people, and I think those people were able to put things out into the world. So mm-hmm. I was able to kind of curate some talent and help them get their visions out there. But when I did get some work produced, it usually wasn't stuff that was getting attention because of what it was selling. It was more in the way that it spoke. Like I worked at a place, you know, called DeVito Verde back in the early 90s, and they were known for doing very audacious, in-your-face, New York wise-ass type of headlines. And the ads themselves spoke in such an unusual way that the ad sometimes became the news. And I worked on a project or two there where it got attention to the culture that way. But I would say it's really just pop culture.
Mm-hmm. But what about BuzzFeed? I mean, so you work for them. I mean, when I think of BuzzFeed, you know, among many other things, because I know they have turned into a news organization as well as, you know, a list organization. But I do think in terms of advertising about their lists, you know, and that that has permeated the social media culture, these list things. Is that related to your involvement at all or not at all?
No, it's not. They were doing lists way before I got there. Mm-hmm. My intention and goal when I did get there was to kind of move them, not off the list, because that was working for them for certain clients and for certain reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I was very clear with the people at BuzzFeed before they brought me on that I had no interest in doing lists, and I didn't really like what they were about. And,
oh, interesting.
And the agreement we made was that, me and my immediate team, we would work on larger creative expressions, maybe, you know, modifications to the site itself that could also work as brand integrations.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have a very long tenure at BuzzFeed. I was there for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. Okay. I was there for like 6 months.
Okay.
It wasn't a cultural fit. I don't think we had similar goals.
Right.
They're doing really well, and I'm glad they are. There's some nice people there. But, you know, we didn't really see eye to eye creatively.
Well, is that
pretty much from the get-go?
Is that fairly typical, maybe, of your relationships, either literally or more figuratively, with clients that you've worked with, particularly corporations, in terms of, you know, I don't really like what they do, but this is going to be a good gig kind of thing?
No, I mean, well, clients is another story. With BuzzFeed, I didn't feel that at all. I felt really good about going into the relationship because Jonah Peretti, who's their founder and CEO, I'm a huge admirer of his and his work that he did before BuzzFeed. He did some really wonderful projects that really played with new media and what and how information goes viral. He's a really brilliant guy. And BuzzFeed, before I had any relationship with them professionally, was publishing a lot of the projects that I was doing, you know, without me asking them to, just because they were being covered in kind of like the, you know, the internet culture, things like the hipster traps and tourist lanes and things like that.
Yeah.
And so his idea was, why don't you just keep doing what you're doing, but there's probably an opportunity for brands to have an involvement in that. I mean, you look at the hipster traps, and which is a project I did where I set bear traps around New York City baited with things that hipsters liked.
Right.
I did that with another New York artist named Hunter Fine. And one of the items that was in the bait was a Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Right.
Now, that one photograph got 1 million views in one day.
Mm.
That could have been an ad for Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Right.
Now, there are other issues about, well, what is art and is there product placement in art? And that's typical in a lot of other, you know, forms of art right now. But, you know, the conversation I was having with Jonah was, wouldn't it be interesting if we created projects that didn't really try to dupe people into thinking they're art? You know, I mean, that the hipster traps were a pure art project. There was no
sure.
corporate involvement.
Right.
But his vision was, and the vision I got excited about was, why don't we do these things that are kind of shareable on the internet that are organically connected to a brand's story in a way that people would like to kind of actually consume? And you don't have to hide the fact that it's an ad because the brand's involvement makes it kind of the idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's another example, a project I did with Chris Baker and Mike Lacker, two people who I did bring into BuzzFeed, was a project called The World's Most Exclusive Website,
mm-hmm.
where to get into this website, you had to be a verified Twitter user. And a lot of people at the time didn't really fully understand what verified Twitter meant. They just meant, a lot of people just assumed it meant, oh, I have to have a legitimate Twitter account. So when they tried to get in, if they weren't a verified user, we would redirect them to some place that was more at their level. This was supposed to be a very exclusive site, only for the cream of the crop of society. Someone at your level, we're going to redirect you to someplace more accessible. We would drop people off at the Olive Garden's website.
Wait a second, Jeff. You probably do need to clarify what verified Twitter user is.
Oh, okay. So a verified Twitter user is someone who has a blue check mark next to their Twitter handle. And that signifies that you're usually someone who's either famous or in the media or someone that people have some reason to impersonate. Donald Trump and Madonna are obviously verified, as are lots of other politicians and artists and people in the press.
Okay.
And so many people, especially then, were not verified. So, you know, thousands of people tried to go to this website, and then they'd get redirected to the Olive Garden. By the way, if they did get in, there was just a succession of rooms where you needed to have more and more and more followers to get into the deeper and deeper and deeper rooms. And people who are at the same, you know, social level could chat with each other or communicate with each other in the deeper rooms. And then a special event would be triggered if someone ever reached the last room. Right now, Kim Kardashian has gotten as far as anyone has gotten, and she's in there alone by herself in one of the deeper rooms. But we sent over 95,000 people to the Olive Garden's website that week. There were people on Twitter saying, if this is an ad for Olive Garden, it's brilliant. It wasn't an ad for Olive Garden, right. But it was interesting to see people saying, this might be an ad, and I really like it anyway. And so what I was hoping to do at BuzzFeed was create more opportunities like that. But just given what the engine of BuzzFeed was at the time in terms of, you know, how they needed to scale and how meet their particular, you know, timelines in terms of delivering creative, there really wasn't an opportunity to do that. And it was my failure in not creating an opportunity for that to happen. I didn't really manage up, as they say, very well. And I learned a lot from failing. I mean, failure in terms of that I was asked to leave. I mean, there were successes too. I mean, I hired a lot of great people who spent a long time at BuzzFeed and enjoyed it and try to improve the creative, and BuzzFeed's doing really well. So, mm-hmm. you know, but my involvement was short-lived. As have been a lot of my employment.
Sure. I got you on the BuzzFeed, so let's drop the BuzzFeed. I think we've covered that. But I do want to ask you the Bear Trap piece, which people should go check out, and they will, hopefully, raises for me an interesting kind of science of advertising question. Because in the classic hipster Bear Trap, you've got, just for people who haven't seen it yet, you've got an American Spirits cigarette pack. You've got these sort of slightly oversized colored, you know, sunglasses that are kind of hipstery, cheesy. A camera, a bike chain.
And a Holga camera.
Okay, got it, right. And then you've got a Pabst Blue Ribbon can. And I wanted to ask you about that because it went viral and people suspected, or, you know, maybe people didn't suspect, but it could have easily been a Pabst Blue Ribbon ad. My question is, when people see it in that context, are they, from your advertising statistics, you know, analysis, would you say that people are just as likely to just say, oh, I could really go for one of those right now? Or are they going to say, oh man, that makes me want to stay away from that. I don't want to be a hipster.
I think both. And sure. Even more options than that. I think there are people who are self-reflective and have a sense of humor about themselves and go, that is me. And if they ever thought it was from the brand, they might be like, oh, that brand actually does get me. There are people who would certainly feel like, oh, I don't want to be associated with anything in this Bear Trap.
right.
But I do think there are a lot more people, given how many people shared it and judging, reading what the comments were, that sometimes even everyone likes to loathe the hipster.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes even the hipsters like to loathe the hipsters, you know,
right.
And sometimes
a
hipster doesn't even recognize himself as one.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Even if they do drink that beer, even if they do smoke that cigarette. But yeah, it's an interesting question, and I'm sure that if you brought it to a brand, that conversation would happen, and that project would not ever live.
Why not?
Which is the history of a lot of the because I think that if you were really having a conversation with Pabst Blue Ribbon and you brought that to them, they'd say, well, we don't want to be. I've never met anyone at that brewery, so I have no idea. But but given conversations I've had in the past with other brands, I can imagine a conversation going, you know, well, it's great, it's funny. First question is, you know, we don't want to be associated with hipsters. Maybe you could, I would probably then walk them through a conversation of, but you know, this is a reality that exists without whether you want it to exist or not. Commenting on it might be interesting. You know?
Yeah.
And if we move them past that, I think the next conversation would be, look, how do we guarantee people will see it? How do we know people will share it? We should really buy some media space. And then it's a print ad or something, or it's no longer a piece of street art. You know,
right.
And so I would just imagine that many clients would be like, hey, why don't we just do this thing that we've seen someone else do before, or that we've done before, or that is, you know, extremely measurable, and we can get detailed analysis of how many people saw it and how many people were emotionally moved by it, and you move into making an ad. you know?
Meanwhile...
Which is probably good, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I was just going to say, meanwhile, all they have to say is thanks for the free advertising.
Right.
For
exactly.
Your piece.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. I don't... Judging by the comments I saw online, I don't think a lot of people did perceive it as an ad. And it wasn't. But here's the interesting thing. When Hunter and I put out the first one, it was kind of a test one. We just didn't know if it would fly away. We didn't know if people would smash it and stomp on it or steal the bait or try to, you know, mess with the trap in some way, or we didn't know. So we just chained one up, you know, we put it out there, kind of walked around the block and came back, and we were looking at it for a while. And there was this guy that was kind of walking by over and over again. And then, you know, we kind of were adjusting some of the props on the trap, and he comes over to us and he says, "Hey, is this yours?" And we go, "No, it belongs to the street. We put it out here." He's like, "Ah, it's cool." He's like, "Is it a hipster trap?" And we were so elated because it was the first time we heard, and no one else had ever seen it besides Hunter and I ever before. None of our friends heard anything,
right?
Except the other guy who made it with us, named Aaron Glazer. He actually built the models. They weren't real traps. They were made of cardboard, but they looked incredibly realistic.
Mm.
We didn't want any, you know, small kids or dogs to get hurt with, you know, putting a real bear trap out there.
Right.
But it looked really good, and there was like fake, you know, dried blood on it, and it looked pretty gruesome and real, and looked metallic, and the chain was real.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he's like, "Well, is it an ad?" And we go, no, it's not an ad." And he goes, "Oh, cool. Can I take a picture of it?" And we go, "Sure." So we took a picture. He gave us his business card. You know, I gave him my contact details. And then Hunter and I went home to try to make a Tumblr. We had never made a Tumblr. This was many, many years ago. We were like, "Oh, I guess we should just start a Tumblr and, you know, throw these pictures up there that we took of it. And when we put other ones out, you know, we'll keep documenting them." And about 3 hours after we had gotten home, after we had met that guy on the street who took the picture, he emailed me and he says, "Hey, I really enjoyed your bear trap and the internet seems to like it too." And he had put it on Reddit. And at that point, it already had 250,000 views.
Mm.
And by the next morning, it had just under 1 million views. And so it's interesting because the very first guy who saw it asked if it was an ad. But when I saw the comments that were on you know, Reddit and stuff, that wasn't really part of the conversation.
Hmm. Right. So did you already call it a hipster trap before this guy asked if it was a hipster trap?
Oh, yeah. We were so, yeah, like our right. file in our, you know, our, right. our, you know, desktop folder with the project was called Hipster Traps.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it was really great that someone else parroted back to us what we were advertising, I guess, taught us how to communicate quickly. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad we're into talking about the pieces, your art pieces, quote unquote, because I always get a little self-conscious on this podcast, you know, talking with somebody about these about gentrification or these abstract things, which is totally fine ultimately, but I know that there is a certain element of the listeners that wants to hear about work. So, I'm glad that we're doing that. And I should say before I go to one of your other pieces that you have such a strong affinity, at least in the context of this podcast, if not just purely out in the world, with Matt Starr and Grayson Earl, you know, your friends slash colleagues who also do social interactive work, activist work, to some extent. More with Grayson for sure, but before I ask you about this next piece, do you see yourself as part of the artistic genre of activist art or social interactive art or something along those lines?
Yeah, I suppose I do. If that's the definition, then yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the projects that I've done, I don't know if I'm going to continue to do projects in that vein, but a lot of the projects I've done were certainly centered around, either drawing people into action or drawing people to get more educated about a particular issue that maybe the news wasn't presenting in a way that they were comfortable digesting
yeah.
or talking about
right.
or thinking about differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The reason that, and it's not important what it's called, actually. I mean, these are just ways to refer to it sort of as opposed to or as distinguished from, you know, maybe more traditional art, gallery art, museum art, you
sure.
know, straight up art. Is that unlike, I feel like when you kind of compare the two in a way, there's a certain ghettoization when you look at the more traditional art, the art that I'm more involved with myself, honestly, because it is limited to the art world, whereas the projects that you and Matt and Grayson do, you know, it's right out there in the public. I mean, from Reddit to the street, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I mean, it's an interesting thing to talk about because, you know, there are certain people just given the nature of society I think at least in New York City, everybody has access to go see fine art all the time. A lot of the museums are pay what you want. So no one should have an economic boundary to exploring, I guess, high art, traditional art or modern art. But certainly bringing art to where people are is also an effective way of trying to, you know, connect with people, especially those who, for whatever reason, feel left out of the art world.
Right. And another way that I thought of it in looking at your work, which actually interestingly relates directly to your comedy, which you do as well, stand-up comedy, is that there's an instant gratification aspect to it. And I wonder if that's something that was just a byproduct of the projects that you're working on, or to what extent you gravitated towards these interactive projects that provided instant gratification consciously.
You know, I think as you just said it, I mean, I am a comedian. I'm also a bit of an activist. I guess now I'm an artist because I've done art projects and people have put artists after my name. They all kind of influence each other. I mean, a lot of the projects that we talked about, while they might have a social, element to them in terms of like raising people's awareness about social issues, they're also fairly comedic or theatrical or strange enough that people want to take notice because they're kind of just strange, you know?
Yeah.
And I think they've all influenced each other. The comedy influences, you know, at least for my process and the process that I share with a lot of the people I collaborate with, like Andrew Titer and Hunter Fine and Chris Baker and Mike Lacker. A lot of the process has started with making fun of something, making jokes about something.
Right.
We might sit around together and actually write jokes. And then it's like, okay, well, how do we take that joke? Because we're each trying to like one-up each other on the jokes. Once, like, we think it's heightened to a pretty, you know, robust place, it's like, okay, could we take that joke and three-dimensionalize it? Could we bring that joke into the world so it has some permanence? And that might become the hipster traps. That might become tourist lanes, which is where I divided up the New York City sidewalks up into two lanes, one for tourists and one for New Yorkers, so people could walk faster and more efficiently through the city.
Right,
the world's most exclusive website, where it's like, you know, making fun of online fame while the very famous participate in the joke, you know? So but what you were saying, I thought was really interesting, because I think what bringing it to the street or the internet does is it does give us some immediate gratification or feedback.
Yeah.
But also there's an audience. You can see the audience. Like people commenting on Reddit or on some level view counts is you can see how many people you've touched. And, you know, maybe I'm just a product of the times, but like that feels good. If you hang a painting in the gallery, it's prestigious and you know that there'll be somewhat of an audience, but there usually aren't comment cards there for people to give feedback.
Right.
And, you know, I'm sure there are lots of artists where they don't give a shit. They don't care what people's thoughts were. There are probably lots of artists who feel the thoughts that the viewer has should remain in their own head for them to grapple with or to talk with their friends about. Everything doesn't need to be published and shared. That's a whole other conversation, I imagine. But for me, I really do like seeing the audience. And that's why I decided to finally get up on stage, because I wanted to see them face to face.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Stand-up comedy is something I've only done for the past year, but I did improv comedy for 15 years. And so another interesting thing, if you don't mind me going on about it, is a lot of these projects, after they've, you know, they were initially made to be on the internet or to be on the street, but then they did wind up in a gallery. I mean, like the Edward Snowden statue, which I did with Andrew Titer, where
we'll get to that.
Well, I mean, we did projects that have been out in the world, and then, you know, they wind up in the Brooklyn Museum, or they wind up in a gallery, or they travel around the country in an art show. And so it's interesting how it's kind of like almost like the press on the internet. Like if Reddit covers something, or Gawker or Gothamist when they were alive, I think maybe Gothamist might be coming back. then once they cover something, the quote unquote legitimate press feels more comfortable covering it, like the New York Times or the, you know, Washington Post. And so it seems that it's a similar kind of trajectory with these art projects. If Avenue B and Second Street likes it, and then Reddit likes it, then maybe a gallery likes it, and then maybe a museum likes it.
You know? Interesting. Yeah. Well, there's so much to unpack about what you were just saying, but I think the main thing that I want to get to, you said just a few minutes back, and an artist, as they sometimes attach to my name. So there's that comment. And then also the way you described your work getting into galleries and museums sometimes. So a couple of questions around both of those things. One is, do you have any ambiguity about calling yourself an artist? And two, do you and those, particularly you and those colleagues that you mentioned, do you segregate yourself from sort of the high art world, would you say, or do you find yourself interacting with it at all, with those people?
Okay, so the first question was, do I have any ambiguity about my title?
Calling yourself an artist.
Yeah, I mean, no, I'm comfortable doing it, but it's relatively new. I mean, it's been a few years. Can I tell you a quick story?
You can.
When I was in advertising, and I still am, but when I was working as a copywriter, I went to go work at Saatchi & Saatchi in San Francisco.
Ah.
And I was teamed with this guy, Joel Rodriguez, who I'm still friends with now.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an art director. And that's the traditional pairing, an art director and a copywriter, traditionally. And so we were working on a project, and Joel says to me, this week, I'm going to think about all the words, and you think about all the visuals. And I got really anxious because I had just moved from New York from that agency that was known for doing very wise-assy, comedic, in-your-face headlines. That's how I got my job, being able to write those.
Mm.
And I said, but I'm a copywriter. I'm not an art director.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, you're not a copywriter. That's just what's on your business card. You're a problem solver. You're a creative guy. Don't limit yourself by your title.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let, you know, that become who you are. And it was really, for me at the time, it really opened my eyes and my mind to that I'm not my business card. And so I've actually given some talks about this where it's like, you know, usually there'll be your name and then there's a comma and it says, you know, copywriter,
right,
or comma creative director, or comma artist or musician. And I think it's the most interesting part of that is the space between the comma and your name, you know, that space between
is, yeah,
a better place to be than falling onto the title. And so the first time I ever saw artist after my name in a newspaper, it was a little jarring.
Mm.
And so sometimes still when people ask me, are you an artist? I flash back to that moment. I'm like, oh, yes, I guess I am. If I'm actually putting work out into the world and making the ideas that I have something people can share, then I guess that is being an artist.
Yeah. Well said.
And then the other part you asked about was, do I segregate myself? No. I mean, I'm really glad that these projects, because they've either gotten attention on the internet or in the press or in a gallery space, has brought me into the attention of people from the traditional art world.
Mm-hmm.
And I have conversations with people in that world. We've talked about doing some collaborations. None of them have happened yet, but I've certainly been introduced to, you know, gallerists and people who work in institutions I never would have rubbed shoulders with. And so who knows what that might lead to? You never know who you'll meet. I'm now at different parties and different social settings, mm-hmm, and I'm meeting people with different ideas and different ways of getting them done.
So this raises a very potentially interesting question. Maybe it'll be a dud, but having come from the advertising, you know, copywriting, it's creative director world, and entering the art world quite late, you know, from the back door, as we said, or whatever metaphor you want to use, how have you found people in the art world? I mean, obviously there's great variety, but I mean, do any of maybe your preconceptions hold true? Is it total mixed bag and nothing predictable? How would you describe it?
I think it's like everything else. You know, I'm 47 now and I've seen a few different industries and I think they're all the same.
Mm.
You know, there's always the same archetypes,
mm-hmm,
you know, and the same people who want to be the gatekeepers. It's, mm-hmm, in advertising, it's in Silicon Valley, it's in the art world. I'm sure,
right,
it exists in the world of plumbers and roofers and in the medical establishment.
I'm sure
everywhere there are the hot ones and the not so hot ones.
Right.
And the people you want to be with and the people who are going to let you in and the people who are going to judge and the people who are going to contribute and collaborate. And so there are the stereotypes and the people who you just look at them and they go, oh, they came from central casting. they're an artist or an artiste. But I could say the same about an executive creative director at a hot shop, or, you know, a developer at Facebook, you know. And so I think the more people I meet, the more I realize we're all the same, you know?
Yeah, that's really insightful. And so as somebody who, from your advertising world perspective, are you like me, or have you like me been frustrated by the gatekeepers, the relative small number of them, and the relative great power that they have?
Yes, totally. And I've been worried because at times I've been a gatekeeper.
How so? Know? Oh, right, because the curator,
someone,
yeah.
You know, or they're firing someone, or hiring mm-hmm. someone, or mm-hmm. trying to bring someone onto a project. And
right.
so, or let somebody into a website that's for people to get creative jobs, which is, you know, somewhat exclusive or curated.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one thing I'm glad about is I'm still making things. I've met a lot of people who, once they arrive at the status or at the station of being a gatekeeper, they've become somewhat lazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
They tend to be older. They tend to have, a lot of times they're resting on their laurels,
mm-hmm.
or a lot of times they've just been a fraud. I find that in advertising more, well, I'm sure it exists in the art world too, but there's a lot of frauds.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a really good fraud, you can, I mean, look who's our president. If you're a really good fraud,
yeah.
you can fool a lot of people and
yeah.
create, people yeah. want, sometimes people just want the image. And if you present the right image without the substance, that's good enough.
Right. How much of a gatekeeper are you right now?
Well, you know, now I have I freelance a lot, so I'm not a gatekeeper in that respect at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I also run a creative and strategic consultancy with Andrew Titer, one of the guys that I've done a lot of these projects we've talked about with.
Right.
And so we do hire freelancers, we do hire strategists, we do hire people to help develop our business. So on some level, we're bringing people in. I don't think we're letting people into. Well, actually, that's not true. I was going to say our true gatekeeper is someone who's letting you into a community, not really just giving you a job. And so we have met some younger people who want to not so much be in advertising, but they have really interesting ideas, and they also want to make a living, and they want to be, you know, getting them into their professional careers is certainly, I guess I still operate in that respect. I still connect people with opportunities. And because I've been doing advertising for 20 years and art for a while now, and comedy for, you know, a while, I do know a lot of people, and I can help people meet people who can help them.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I guess I am, but I'm still looking for gigs. So, you know, I'm not in some ivory tower by any stretch of the imagination.
Right. Or another way to put it is a self-aware gatekeeper is a relatively benign gatekeeper, you know, one who's aware
yeah.
that they're a gatekeeper. I mean, that's not very common.
I guess.
In other words,
yeah,
if
I
somebody, if you go back to some of those guys that you described earlier, you know, the ones who are resting on their laurels, they're probably not very cognizant of the degree to which they're gatekeepers, you know?
I wonder. I don't know. I mean, they appear not to be, but they must know. I mean, they must look in the mirror at night, or when they're lying in bed with their thoughts, they know they're not, they know, they must know.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suffer from imposter syndrome all the time. A lot of creative people I know do. And sometimes I'm in rooms, I'm like, how did I get here?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
someone's going to drag me out of this room any moment. Like
right.
I'm supposed to go on stage to give a talk, and I'll be thinking, someone's going to be like, I'm sorry, sir, this was a huge mistake. Like you are not meant to be booked here.
Interesting.
Because what could I possibly have to offer people? You know, I'm just trying to figure things out like everyone else. But
right.
I'm just really honest about it. I guess the ones who really put on the act really well, the ones who just stay in confidence so well. Right?
I think that's actually a really good way to distinguish what I suggested earlier, which is this lack of awareness about having power, being the gatekeeper. It's more being self-conscious about it and being recognizing the power. I think that I'm talking about and being humble about it, as opposed to just being power
sure.
hungry.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I'm in. I've been doing stand-up comedy for just a little over a year now, and I did an audition recently at a club here in the city. And I've, you know, what comics usually try to do in the city is they try to get a pass at a club. you try to find the club that's going to, you know, have a good audience that you can get on stage on a good night. And to do that, it's a long process. You got to do a lot of open mics, then you got to go to these auditions. And a lot of these clubs will require you for the audition to bring 10 or 15 or 20 people. We'll all have to pay.
Yeah.
It's a real racket on some level. And there are gatekeepers, certainly, in that world. Mm. Who's going to let you on the stage?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And who's going to give you the right night? And who's going to make sure they don't slot you up when everyone's getting their check, the check slot, which is, you never want that, you know? And I finally did this club, and the guy that gave me this, oftentimes the people who book you won't even watch your show.
Mm.
So there's no way to get any feedback. You don't grow. And I recently did this audition, and the gatekeeper there, his name is Rich, and he gave really insightful feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, he watched my show. He watched my tape. He was someone who felt like he knew, yeah, I'm here to keep booking people at a club, but I also have to kind of grow the community. You know, I have to kind of, you know, nurture the community. And it's in his, probably in his best interest to cultivate better talent, you know,
mm-hmm.
not just curate it, but cultivate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when a gatekeeper really, is shining.
Right.
When they're not only, you know, deciding who gets in and who doesn't, but they see who has potential and helps them, you know, maybe come back to the door a little bit later.
Yeah.
And knock on it again.
Right. And for people listening, if they haven't already, they can go to your site and maybe we'll put a embed of it on your episode page of your stand-up set at, was it Gotham Comedy Club?
That was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that one's at Gotham. That's a pretty old one. I can put up
right.
a new one.
Yeah, I just wanted to point it out because it's a very successful set. And you say you've only been doing it a little over a year. And I was wondering, because I just was rewatching some of it before we got on the phone, and I was wondering, have you not had as sets as good as that since then, at least that were filmed, and that's why you still have that up? Or I mean,
well, I'll tell you how it works. You know, Gotham is a club that provides you with a really great tape in terms of
sure.
it's got great lighting and
right.
great sound.
Right.
So a lot of times I'll do a really good set at a club and then I'll see the tape and I'm like, that's not really usable.
Yeah.
So it's, you want to have this perfect storm of when you do a good set, you know, and the audience reacts well.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's the technical issues, as you know, doing a podcast, it's like you might have great content, but is it presentable?
Yeah.
And so I haven't done a lot of tape shows because I've only been doing it for, I started on September 25th of 2016 was my first show.
Mm-hmm.
And so that tape up there was 6 months old. And it's only been up there. I will keep everything up there, but it's the latest one because it was the last one that was like good quality until this one I did about 2 weeks ago, which I'll put up after this conversation. A lot of it's the same material. That's the other thing. You know, when you do these audition sets or when you're at a club with, when you are going to get the good lighting and the good sound, you also want to do the stuff that's worked the best. And oftentimes the stuff that's worked the best is the stuff that you've been working on the longest.
Sure.
So a lot of times the material only, the tapes only change by one or two jokes at a time, even
mm-hmm.
though I'm trying new stuff every single night at clubs, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. Well, maybe we'll come back to the comedy a bit later, but I've been postponing because we keep going off into these interesting tangents, a couple of your pieces. One, and so the Snowden one, I think we'll definitely want to cover a bit of, but before we get to that, the one that made me laugh out loud of the pieces that I looked at, and I looked at pretty much all of them on your site, is the statue experiment. So I'm going to just assume, we're just going to assume that listeners have not looked at this yet. Would you like to describe, without giving the reveal until a little bit later in, how that piece came to be?
So the statue experiment took place at the High Line, which is an outdoor park. I guess all parks are outdoor. It's an above ground park
right.
in New York City.
Right.
And there was a statue there of a woman with her hands outstretched. And it's a pretty cool statue. They changed the statues and the artwork that's there, you know.
Right.
And so it's this statue. And I was noticing that lots of people were kind of just not paying much attention to it. And then I had this kind of strange idea that I thought was kind of simple that might get people to look at it. And so I had left the High Line. I went to go have lunch with my friend Martin, and I told him the idea, and he goes, oh yeah, that'd be pretty funny. Do you think anyone would notice? I go, I don't know. Why don't we go find out? I have the prop that we need at my apartment. Let me just go get it. If I go get it, will you come with me back to the High Line and we'll film it? And he said, sure. And I went home and grabbed what I needed and brought it to the statue and placed it in front of the statue. And
you didn't say what it is yet.
Yeah. So the thing that I grabbed from my apartment was a fishbowl, and I threw some change and a dollar bill into the fishbowl, and I placed the fishbowl in front of the statue. And then people thought the statue was a person acting like a statue. And all of a sudden, you know, throngs of people were gathered around, so many so that security had to come. And people were debating whether
that's awesome.
People were debating whether the statue was indeed real, and people were afraid to touch it, and people were posing with it. And so I captured that on video, and I, you know, edited it together really quickly, and I threw it up on Twitter and you know, on YouTube. And then I tweeted out to a couple of people in New York, I think maybe the High Line and the New York Post. And then I went to the gym. And then like an hour later, it had, you know, I don't know, like 500,000 views or something like that. And then it got a million by the next day.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting to watch how something so simple could make people so happy, you know?
Here's my title for that and maybe your future lecture. How to Throw Up a Million Hits on YouTube by Jeff Greenspan.
Wow, I don't know if I can live up to that talk or that promise, because I just did a video that I really, really loved, and I thought it was important. And, you know, really relative to the statue and the fishbowl, it's got no views. It's got maybe 3,100 views, only maybe, you know, fewer than 600 on YouTube, and the rest are on Facebook. Are you familiar with what crisis actors are?
Crisis actors? No, yeah. I don't think so. Tell me.
Okay. So Alex Jones and conspiracy theorists on the internet believe that many of the massacres that we've witnessed, like Sandy Hook or the Bataclan shooting in France or the Orlando shooting at the Pulse nightclub,
mm-hmm.
are staged with what they call crisis actors.
Wow. Uh-huh. Right.
And that many of these are either fake,
mm-hmm.
or that the eyewitness accounts are bogus. And those are being performed by crisis actors.
Right.
And so now that's an information bubble that a lot of people who only get exposed to mainstream news will immediately write off as crazy and don't even know the details that they use as facts to support these claims.
Mm-hmm.
So I, along with some friends who want to remain anonymous, we created Inside the Crisis Actor Studio.
Mm-hmm.
Where a James Lipton lookalike,
mm-hmm.
Riffing off the show Inside the Actor Studio,
right.
would sit down with the quote-unquote actors who are making these massacres real. And through the satire, you start to realize the things that this other subculture believes are facts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it was a fun and interesting and provocative and challenging way to get people to, you know, talk about alternative news, fake news, but really no one's picked up on it. So, I certainly don't know how to get a million views all the time.
Got it. But to go back, I wanted to break down the statue experiment a little bit more to go back right. to it. First of all, to me, it was really gratifying and really in a jarring sort of way, how in the video, the crowd flocked to this statue, and it just became this. I mean, on one hand, if you break it down in terms of cause and effect, it's like you could call it a hoax, right? Here's Jeff grabbing a fishbowl and doing a really good hoax, right? But to watch the experience unfold, it felt more like this sort of you know, Improv Everywhere, which, you know, you used in another one of your pieces, but it also felt like just this kind of street performance gone completely viral. And I don't know, how much money did you get from all of those people that thought it was a living statue, and you donated it to a mime, right?
Yeah, not much. You know, people were throwing in quarters. I think someone else threw in a dollar, a lot of nickels and stuff.
Okay.
And then, yeah, I mean, you know, probably like $7 or $6, you know,
okay,
you know,
sorry.
I think I started off with like a dollar and, you know, 50 cents or whatever it was. But
right.
Yeah, and then I was like, well, I don't want to keep this money. And so I thought, you know, why not give it to another street performer? And he was the next one over. So
right.
I gave it to him.
Got it. Okay. But is there anything else
We're
you want to say?
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say about how that went down in terms of what I was saying?
Well, yeah, it's a hoax. But I think it's also an interesting behavior experiment.
Yes. You know? Yes, exactly.
About what if other, I mean, certainly once there's also a tipping point of when, how many people gawking at something is enough to make other people gawk without even knowing why.
Right.
I think maybe, I don't know who it was. It may have been Improv Everywhere, but I'm not sure. Somebody else I know tried something where they just got people to stare at something and other people would stare. I'm not quite sure. I don't remember.
Sure, sure.
But it was just interesting how there's all this artwork around you, and until it becomes a spectacle, it's not worth looking at.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sometimes that's a little sad. There's a lot of great things we probably overlook in today's society because there's no spectacle attached to it. And it's not like that was the statement. I wasn't trying to make some heavy, heady statement with it, but you know, you can look at it and then, you know, say, okay, well, what do we give our attention to and what do we share? And I certainly, you know, people wouldn't have shared the artwork. That statue wouldn't have gone viral without the performance, but one might argue that that statue didn't capture people's imagination enough. So it didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. And it was also the ultimate satire of the living sculpture as well, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about Snowden. I mean, I think we would be remiss if we didn't at least get into that a little bit. I don't know how much detail we need to get into because, again, people can go to your site or go to mine and see sort of the basics about it. But essentially, you and your frequent collaborator collaborated with this sculptor who I guess is like he's a traditional sort of he does traditional realistic sculptures. So you guys collaborated on creating this 4 foot high Snowden bust, correct? And you want to take it from there?
Right. Yeah. So we were pretty, Andrew Titer and I were pretty concerned about the way mainstream media was covering the Snowden situation at the time. Mm-hmm. It was mostly one-sided towards him being an enemy of the state.
Right.
There was certainly some discussion about was he a hero or not, but it wasn't as balanced. And so we were like, how could we get people to consider his actions heroic? And so we looked to what the visual nomenclature of hero worship was in this country, and we settled upon a statue. Originally, it was going to be a full-body statue. It became a bust once we collaborated with Doyle Trakina, who's the sculptor.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we decided to make this bust, we had to figure out where we were going to put it. And when we found the place that we did install it, which was the Prison Ship Martyrs Monument in Fort Greene, Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
that's a monument that honors those who lost their lives during the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
And once we found that location and that empty pillar that existed there, we were like, well, this is kismet. This is now a much bigger and more powerful narrative. If you can connect those who lost their lives to the foundation of this country and the ideals that it was built upon, and those who continue to sacrifice their lives for the same ideals, if you can connect those two, that becomes a lot more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we became doubly committed to finish that project. And then we worked for 6 months with the sculptor who lives in Los Angeles, and then we shipped it here. And then
wait a second, Jeff.
Sorry.
Let me jump in. So that I'm a little surprised, or maybe more than a little surprised, that your collaborator, your sculptor, is in LA. First of all, how did you find him? And you know, were there no sculptors a little closer to home?
That's a really good question. We went through, you know, we didn't know any sculptors when we set out to do this project. We called around to people that we knew who did sculptural work.
Right.
And it wasn't encouraging. A lot of people were like, this is not a small little side project. This is going to be months and months and months of work.
Right.
It's going to cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, well, okay, so now we had to find not only a sculptor who was competent and had enough artistic talent to pull this off, but believed in the vision enough to do this at pretty much cost. And so that, you know, we did find another sculptor. For originally we were going to try to 3D print it and build it.
Mm-hmm.
And that really didn't go anywhere. And then through a friend of a friend, we found the sculptor who lived in LA. And of course there was concern, but he was the only, originally we were really talking with him, I think, to get some advice. Cause it's possible that we didn't even think we could pull it off if he was in LA. But mm-hmm. when we talked to him, he became really committed to the idea too, and agreed to not charge us anything other than what he paid in materials.
Wow.
Which brought it down from, you know, originally we were quoted from people around, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 to make a sculpture like
this. Wow.
And he did it for the cost of materials.
Awesome.
And we, you know, yeah, it was awesome. So we required someone who had a belief in the vision.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. I don't mind talking about it, but, you know, this hasn't been discussed too much. This project, as it wound down, as the sculpture was actually done,
mm-hmm.
and we were it had already been flown to New York,
mm-hmm.
and the sculptor, we were flying him out to New York too for the day that we were going to install it, and he was doing some research on his own on the location that we were installing it, and he called us up and he said, "Were you aware that there are bodies buried there?" And we said, "Well, they're not really bodies buried there. There are remains that are entombed inside the memorial." Yes. And he said, "Well, I have some mixed feelings about this now. I mean, this is desecrating a grave and a sacred space." And I said, "Listen, I'm sure you're getting this information from the Wikipedia page because you live in LA, but trust me, this is not a sacred space. It's not treated as one as such.
Uh-huh.
People are playing frisbee on it, and their dogs are taking pisses and shits on this thing.
Right.
And it's gone into such a state of disrepair at some point that it looked abandoned. And this is not a graveyard, and this is not a sacred space." And he just did not feel comfortable with it. And
uh-oh.
To make a very, very long story short, we went back and forth because he felt so uncomfortable that he really did not want us to go through with cementing this onto this pillar. And so we tried to reach some compromises, one of which that was floated out, why don't we just try to get it into a gallery space? And that was never the intent of the project.
Mm-hmm.
It was always meant to be in public, and especially at this space.
Mm-hmm.
So the compromise that we reached was we would use a different type of sealing agent. The original sealing agent would have cured in probably an hour, but this sealing agent took many, many hours to actually form a complete bond,
mm-hmm.
which turned out to be because he felt that would have been easier to remove the damage to the. He said, if for some reason they don't take this away in 7 or 8 hours, then it's going to require mechanical removal, and you might chip the original pillar that we're cementing it on.
Mm.
And we were like, it's probably going to be taken away much earlier than that. But to make everyone feel comfortable, we used a different sealing agent. And
what?
It turned out to be amazing because the police did come and take it away. And
right.
When they took it away, they covered it up. And they left it covered up for a good while in front of journalists with cameras. So now the next image event that came out of this was the authorities covering up a man who's trying to reveal government, trying to call for more
yeah.
government transparency.
Right, right.
You couldn't have planned this to be better, you know?
So let me just ask a couple quick practical right. questions. How long did you anticipate, you and your collaborator, not the sculptor, but you and your regular collaborator, think that it would stay up before they took it down? And how long, in fact, did it take?
We went back and forth, Mike. I mean, we thought maybe an hour, maybe a day. Maybe, you know, is it possible they could leave it there? Of course not. Like, we had all these conversations, but it was a complete unknown. We didn't even know if we'd get away with it. We thought we might get caught in the midst of doing it. We really thought it was best to, after having lots of conversations about what could be, is to enter it with no expectations, because there were too many other things to worry about logistically to get this done.
Right.
And so, did you have another question about the process?
I probably will have more, but I mainly just wanted to uh-huh. interject with how long uh-huh. It actually took to get taken down. Yeah.
So we got to the park, I think, at 4:30 in the morning. I think that we had finished the scaffolding around it by about 5 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna guess we were out of there by 5:30, 5:45 a.m. And I think it was taken away at 11 or noon. I think,
okay.
if I remember my timeline correctly.
Okay.
But we were really fortunate to have met a guy named Bucky Turco. Bucky Turco ran a website called Animal, which is no longer in business. And Animal was a news source dedicated to street art and other types of art too, but primarily street art. And so we didn't know if we'd get caught. We didn't know how long it would be up. We had invested a lot of money, a lot of people's talent, a lot of time, a lot of practice, almost a year of work to do this. And so we wanted to try to make sure that there was someone documenting this that was interested in sharing at least the attempt if we couldn't get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so after, you know, some failed attempts at reaching people at the press who were sympathetic to it, we found Bucky. And so what Bucky did is he while we were waiting for the ground to thaw, because it was too cold initially to install it, he was putting together a piece that was going to run. And so he created a whole video that explained who Edward Snowden was, explained the significance of the space that we were about to do what we were going to do. And then he sent someone there to film us and document us installing it. And then that videographer, ran back to Animal Studios and slit in all the footage of the install where there were spaces left in the video, so that Animal was able to get the video up online, I think, like maybe, you know, just a few hours after we did the install, with all our faces blurred and everything. Mm. So, yeah, so we knew that at least the attempt would be documented, and in the perfect world, the successful installation would be at least seen by the world before it was taken away. It was seen by, you know, thousands of people before, you know, the cops even got to the statue.
Right. So we're at a stopping point here. How much money did you guys invest in producing this piece?
Well, I just don't know if the sculptor wants it out there, how much he charged for the materials. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So
okay.
We've never really discussed that. I just know that the original quote, like, for him to do that with his time would have been like 30 or 40.
Instead of informing people how much he charged you for materials, let's just say that you and your colleague invested a significant sum for this.
Plus,
you are risking potential... I don't know, arrest, confiscation, etc.
And I can tell you how we avoided that as well.
Sure. So take it where you will.
So, even with the discount, I don't even want to call it a discount. Even with him not charging us for his artistry and his time, Andrew and I both still had to invest, thousands each.
Sure.
To get it done.
Yeah.
And plus, we also obviously risked arrest. And we were also very aware that, you know, the people that we had help us, we had quite a few friends actually physically help us hoist this and cement it and get it in there. They all had to be aware of their risks. And we felt a certain responsibility to them as well, even though everyone knew the risks involved. Ultimately, we got away with it unscathed.
What time in the middle of the night did you install it?
We got to the park at around 4:30 in the morning.
Okay.
And we took about a half hour to get the scaffolding ready.
Okay.
And to move this very heavy sculpture uphill, there's a hill. So I think we probably started the install probably around 5:30, mm-hmm. I would think.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were out of the park by around 6,
okay.
Maybe 6:15.
Okay.
And then Ron Kuby, who's a very famous civil rights lawyer, he's actually the guy in The Big Lebowski when the dude is calling for, says, "Get me Ron Kuby." He's a
right.
real guy. He
right.
exists. He's our lawyer.
Right.
So he stepped forward. He got in touch with us through Bucky Turco, the gentleman who ran Animal.
Right.
Because we were anonymous.
Right.
So only Bucky knew our identities. So he became kind of a clearinghouse for the press, for other press outlets, and for people who wanted to help us or help us get the statue back or defend us legally.
Right.
And so Ron Kuby got in touch with him, and then we were put in touch with Ron Kuby, and he offered his services for free in terms of getting the statue back from the NYPD, and he was successful in doing that. He got it returned to us, and it immediately went into the Postmaster's Gallery. It went into a group show at the Boiler in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
That was a group show where multiple galleries in New York submitted pieces to be shown there. And the Postmaster's Gallery wanted us to have the Snowden statue be their submission into the group showing. And so we got it back just the day before the show opened. It was like right up until the edge, because when Postmaster's contacted us, we told Magda, who runs it, that we didn't have the statue yet, that the city had agreed to give it back, but we weren't in possession of it yet. And we got it back just the day before the show opened.
Was the piece for sale in that show?
No, it was not.
Okay. What's the status of it as an object?
Well, after appearing in a couple of galleries in New York City, it wound up having a long run at the Agitprop show at the Brooklyn Museum. And it was there for about 6 months.
Mm.
It's made some other appearances at other shows around New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But right now it's in Andrew Titor's living room. so we, we would love for it to find a space where it could be seen by the public,
right?
And still educate and inform people about issues which are still worth discussing.
Sure. So have there been any conversations with institutions about that?
We've tried. There have been some people who have, you know, come forward saying that they want to connect us to this person or that institute, or none of it has come to fruition yet. There have been people who have been interested in purchasing it, but, you know, part of our stipulation would be that it would be, you know, available for the public to actually see for significant amounts of time.
Yeah.
And so those things haven't all those I's haven't been dotted and T's crossed yet to make that happen. So
how would you anticipate, or how would you explain the reluctance of institutions that might otherwise be interested?
I don't think it's so much that institutes are reluctant. I just think, it only came out of the Brooklyn Museum. Well, it did come out of the Brooklyn Museum, I guess, about maybe, 8 months to a year ago at this point. I don't sense a reluctance. There have been people who've been interested to like show it, but it's also, a delicate piece, and we're not really excited about sending it off somewhere to be shown for 1 or 2 days, you know?
Sure.
So there have been people who, it requires someone who has the space for it, who has the appetite to, allow the public to see it. I feel like it'll be exhibited again. I mean, I hope that it does. I think it's still a relevant conversation, and it's still in wonderful condition, and it's still aesthetically an amazing piece of art.
Yeah.
Even the NYPD, when they were returning it to us, said, we will hand it to you guys. It is a beautiful piece of art.
Right. Of course. They can appreciate realism when they see it. It's bronze, I take it?
Actually, it's not. It's hydrocal.
Which
is a combination.
Right.
Yeah. It's hydrocal. And so it's a combination of concrete and fiberglass. And it's got a bronzed outer layer. It's not true bronze. It's been painted bronze and then painted to look patina.
I see. Interesting. Huh. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the artist's, hesitation to move forward with it at that 11th hour. What has been his feeling about it since then? And, what has become of his business since then, if anything?
Well, he's an amazing artist who works with another well-known artist very frequently. So he's still, prolific and working. I've noticed the last time I went to his website that the statue was not part of his collection of work. So I'm wondering what his feelings are now. Our relationship became a bit strained at one point because of all the we were really having a hard time coming to an agreement about what to do with the statue. At one point, it was decided that we would just put it in a storage room and that would be the end of that. It was not – we didn't want to, statue in our possession. On some level, we could have done anything we wanted with it. But, as a fellow artist, we didn't want to abuse his feelings and abuse his artwork. And if he had such strong reservations against this appearing in a way that he felt was sacrilegious, we just couldn't go through with that with a good conscience, He was such an integral part of the work. There was no way we could have violated his emotions that way.
What was the situation that would have been sacrilegious to him?
Yeah, so at one point, we talked about, well, we'll just put it in a storage unit, and that didn't sit well with him either. So we came to the compromise that we did, and it all worked out for everyone. How he feels about it, he certainly, unless his views on surveillance and Edward Snowden have changed, he was very gung-ho about doing this. He devoted tons of his time and energy and talent and artistry to make this happen. So I can only assume he still believes in the cause.
Yeah.
But like I said, he hasn't put – the last time I went to his website, it wasn't in his collection of work.
Right.
But that – who knows? He might not update his site very often.
Who is the artist
but
that he –
But he's been – Doyle Trakina.
No. Who does – I was going to ask – okay, Doyle Trakina, that's good to know. But I was going to ask, who is the artist that he frequently fabricates for?
I don't know if he wants me to
– Ah, interesting.
To do that, yeah.
And that works not on his website?
I don't have a site in front of me. May or may not be.
Okay. We'll have to suss that out.
I would imagine it's not.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, a little mystery is always a nice tease.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think we, unless there's anything else you want to say about that, I guess maybe I could ask one other question about one sort of last final Snowden question. And that is, I think you made clear, you and your collaborator, what your intention was going in. You made that, you make that very clear on your website and earlier in this conversation. Do you feel though, through the process, that you maybe helped spread some good backing of Snowden as a historical, contemporary historical figure?
Absolutely, yeah. I think he would have achieved that without our help, but I certainly contributed. It certainly brought a lot of people who weren't aware of who he was.
Yeah.
It brought a lot of awareness to people who may not have understood him fully. There are a lot of people who, when we talk to them, they'd be like, oh, yeah, Edward Snowden, the WikiLeaks guy. No, he's not a WikiLeaks guy. He doesn't operate at all the way that Julian Assange does.
Right.
In fact, they, you know, so it's interesting how something could be covered in the news over and over again, but whether on whether by design or by accident, the details don't sit with people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then false facts take root.
Yep.
Even when they are watching, I'm making air quotes, legitimate news, because I don't think almost any of the news is legitimate. But what passes for mainstream legitimate news, even when they are disseminating facts and figures and details, the finer points get lost on a lot of people, and the finer points are important.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the distinction between his actions and Julian Assange's actions are it's an important distinction.
Very important.
And so if you're, and it's right. So if you're walking around saying, oh, that WikiLeaks guy, yeah, he should go to prison. He should come back from Russia. They should kill him. I mean, you're basing all your facts on a false premise.
Yeah.
You know?
That's almost tragic, that, you know, that misunderstanding.
It is tragic. And you know, when we did this, this was before, you know, all this discussion about Russian influence or outside influence on our news stream and who's tainting it and who is not, how much of that is coming from within, and how much of it was, how much of us questioning this was the design in the first place. Wasn't the whole purpose to make people question whether their own reality, just reality itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're actually questioning what facts are.
Yeah.
So, and I have to do that too. I have to question my facts about Snowden because I only know them from Glenn Greenwald.
Sure.
You know, I know them from, you know, a Washington Post story.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly other outlets since. So I think you asked, like, does this project help solidify him as, you know, as a hero or as a historical figure? I mean, I think it certainly does. I mean, not that Wikipedia is the end all be all of historical documentation. But I mean, someone made a Wikipedia page of the Edward Snowden statue.
Right.
And in that it contains the story of who he is, as not that you need to only go there to get that, but I mean, history will mark that we and other people have made statues of his likeness to promote him into the world as a hero.
Right.
Interesting,
yeah, I think
at a time when people are taking down other statues.
Yeah, no, I think Jeff, you actually raised kind of what I intended my question to be more. For you personally, was Edward Snowden a hero to you going in, and or did he become more of a hero to you having done the project?
Well, I'll tell you this: he was a hero to me before. He's a hero to me now. Seeing what we had to go through just to put a statue up in a park, and
yeah,
the way my heart raced and the risks involved, what he undertook is a billion times that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So he can't even have his life anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
If someone told me you can put up this Edward Snowden statue, but you can't have your life anymore the way that you know it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done that. And I don't know how many things in my life I would for.
Right.
Luckily, I haven't been tested too often. Actually, you know what? Maybe I have been tested, and I failed the test, which goes back to the very beginning of our conversation, because I still stay in advertising. So, I mean, I haven't stood up and said, but really, advertising isn't the real problem. It's a system. It's a system. It's a particular system, and I support it. We all support it. When we buy stuff, when we go to work, we agree. We submit. We say, okay, it's not the way I want it, but it's the best out there, right?
Yeah.
It's a better system than anything else out there. And how do we even know that? Because the news tells us that? Have we traveled a lot to see how other systems work? I mean, we have news from other places, but can we be sure of what that news is? What is propaganda? What is real? The only way to really maybe know is to go out and travel the world. And fewer, you know, only slightly more than a third of Americans even have a passport. So we live in a system where we're told it's the best system. We don't see outside the system, and we keep trudging along. So, you know, I'm not, you know, rising up and saying I'm not gonna live my life this way. Edward Snowden did. Edward Snowden said, these are ideals worth preserving, worth fighting for. And if I have to lose my well-being for it, then so be it.
Yeah, and I imagine as you're describing all that, that when you do your advertising, which you certainly have mixed feelings about, that the projects that you take on are informed by that knowledge, by that perspective, you know, that you're not going to go into a campaign, you know, should you land one, that is going to spread, you know, manipulative BS or, you know, or overly consumption-based propaganda out into the world. Am I right?
Right. And, you know, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with advertising. There's nothing wrong with telling people about the truth of a service or a product. Most advertising that I'm involved with is branding advertising, where we're not really telling you, you know, what something is made of or why this is particularly better in a legitimate way. It's more of almost like lifestyle branding, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And advertising itself isn't bad. In fact, there's incredible opportunities for advertising and brands now more than ever because they have to appear more as real people because of Instagram, because of Twitter, because of Facebook and social media, and people no longer relying on watching a TV commercial at a set time. Advertising brands kind of have to be more creative, and I would argue eventually will have to be more useful.
Mm-hmm.
And as advertising becomes useful in terms of like giving people something, some benefit for having spent time with the brand. And I don't mean just by having a laugh and seeing a funny video. I mean, you can put things into the world that are pretty much services wrapped up as advertising. I could get into it, but there are examples that I
Go ahead with one example that represents that.
All right, so here's an example. Andrew Titor and I were recently asked to work for Virgin Atlantic Airlines through another agency and as freelancers. And, you know, Virgin Atlantic wanted to have more of a presence in America. And this goes right back directly to what I was just talking about before, about Americans getting outside of America. And so we're asked to do this campaign, you know, just a few months ago. So we're in a climate of America becoming more isolationist, people within America retreating to their own corners of points of view and not really communicating with each other. It's a real opportunity for a brand that has airplanes to say, hey, why don't you go out and see the world and have a more formed opinion about the world? Get to know the people that you are saying we should ban from coming into this country. Go to some of these countries, meet other people, experience the world. Since you are in America and have such a large influence over the world. But like I said before, only about 36% of Americans even have a passport. So Virgin could create centers where getting a passport is really fun and exciting and shareable on social media. You could create pop-up centers where people could get good wardrobe and great lighting and great makeup and hair, and maybe even have celebrity photographers take your picture. And obviously your passport photo has to be a neutral, straight-on photo, but there's no reason you can't get the outtakes for your social media presence, and we can file all the paperwork for you. And that could be an ad. That's something people would talk about. People would probably, I would imagine, put on Instagram. They'd probably share the great photos they got and talk about where they got them. And now we've put the passports into hopefully thousands and thousands and thousands of more Americans' hands. And so to me, that's a really good ad for Virgin.
So this is in the works or has it already happened? Where are we in that process?
It's something that was presented, but, you know, like I said at the beginning of the conversation, who knows if there's an appetite to really do that?
Right.
You know, I know that it was presented to, I believe it was presented to the client. You know, as a freelancer, you don't really have, you know, purview into, you know, how a piece of work moves through the system all the time. But that's the approach that I bring to the work. That's the approach Andrew Titor brings to the work. And that's the approach that we both bring to the work when we operate a side project, which is our consultancy. We figure, how can the brand be useful? Mm-hmm. How can the brand be relevant? Mm-hmm. How can the brand be fun and engaging in a way that says, I actually get you, or I'm going to, you know, maybe you have a voice that is underheard in the world. We can help give you a voice. The brand doesn't have to, you know, operate in a traditional advertising way. And I know there are lots of creatives in this industry who want to do this, but it takes a willingness on the part of the client to do this as well. And also, a lot of ad agencies aren't set up to monetize these types of ideas and these types of expressions, or even build them. So there's a lot of points of failure in getting an idea that's maybe, you know, outside of a TV commercial out into the world.
So in other words, just
I think there,
to clarify this campaign, you're talking about potentially a project or a campaign in which Virgin Atlantic is funding passport awareness and action. And through that, people may or may not actually purchase Virgin Atlantic travel.
Exactly. I mean, I'm sure if they built that idea, they could build elements into it like, hey, you know, if you do come and get your passport photo taken with us, you'll get a discount on a ticket,
right?
Or it's possible that we'll have celebrity photographers there one day, and you can only come in that day if you purchase a future ticket. You know, there's ways that you could, push and pull the levers to make it more or less about Virgin at different times of the year. But I still think it's a good expression for Virgin to put out into the world, saying, I mean, especially a brand that's so sexy. Virgin is a very sexy brand. The process of getting a passport shouldn't be bureaucratic and filled with paperwork and drudgery and a crappy photo that you're left with for 10 years. Virgin can make you excited to look good. You're going to pull out that passport every time and think of Virgin.
Right.
And to me, that's a wonderful opportunity. And there's thousands of opportunities for brands to do interesting, provocative, fun, engaging, useful work. So I think advertising gets a bad rap because it's allowed it to get such a bad rap. It talks to people like they're idiots for the most part. You know, like I say, on my website, which you started the conversation with by reading, you said, you know, we help brands not talk to people like jerks.
Yeah.
And most brands do.
So now that we've shared all of that information about Virgin, whether or not they'd move forward with your campaign, are you going to be able to access your connections there to help sponsor this episode through them? Because that would be nice for me.
I have no, you're in the wrong place for help on that, my friend, man. I mean, I don't know anyone at Virgin. This was done through another ad agency that Andrew and I were fortunate enough to freelance
right.
at. And we enjoyed it. and so, I'm sorry. I'm trying to think. I can help you get access to Ron Kuby if this podcast ever winds up putting you in legal trouble.
Okay, that's good to know. That's good to know. I appreciate that offer. You know, it might not really come down to that, but it is good to know. It's a nice cushion. Yeah, you're right.
You could be guilty by association. Look at the people you talk to. You talk to a bunch of criminals.
Right. Well, so one maybe final point on the Snowden project that you had a civil, you and Andrew had a civil, what are they called? The ticket that you guys?
It's a civil offense. We both got ticketed $50 each for being in the park after it was closed, that was the offense that Ron Kuby was able to negotiate them down to. So we have no records and we paid our fines and we retrieved our statue. And we're thankful that the NYPD took such good care of it when it was in their custody.
Yeah. Nice. One thing that I was thinking of, and I can't remember if I brought this up in a prior podcast or not, but being that you are a comedian and you also work in advertising, I can't help but think of Bill Hicks. And I don't know to what degree you're familiar with his legacy.
I'm very familiar with Bill Hicks, I'm ashamed that he wouldn't probably even, he'd spit on me.
He'd spit on you, right. And just for listeners to clarify, one of his most infamous bits is where he asked the audience if there's anybody in advertising or marketing. And he asked them again.
And then he says,
kill yourselves.
No, seriously, kill yourself.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
Kill yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So what did you feel like when you...
If you can shit... He also said, I don't care if you can shit Mona Lisa's out of your ass on cue. If you do anything in the advertising profession, you are immediately and forever banned from the artistic community.
Oh, I didn't hear that version of that joke. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So when you heard that, what, you know, being in advertising as long as you have yourself, what were your feelings?
Well, you know, when I first was introduced to Bill Hicks, I had no aspirations of being a comedian or an artist or anything. I was a kid.
Right.
And he certainly did influence me. He influenced me to try a lot of drugs, and I'm glad that he did that, especially psychedelics. I agree with him more and more as I get older. But I mean, and I've grappled with killing myself, but not because of this. Well, maybe it is because of this. But he's a purist, man. You know,
right.
He lived or died by his. By his beliefs and his words, and like Snowden, I'm not there. It goes back to what I said before. I'm on some level, I understand the hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And you know, how can you, on the one hand, isn't it wrong to be interviewed like this? I mean, it's great that the work that I've done has, you know, garnered the attention of someone like you who wants to spend time and ask me questions about it. That's amazing. But isn't it phony? Because I'm you know, I've done projects that call out corporate America for the crimes they've committed, like in the Capture Project, which is the project where we had people in prison, paint and draw people who we feel should be in prison, which are the heads of companies who are committing atrocious crimes across the world.
Mm.
Isn't it wrong to do that and then also do advertising? It goes right back to what we said before. It's like there's no doubt there's a hypocrisy in there, but one could also see from another point of view where it's like, I'm using the resources that I have from the career that I have to try to offset some of the damage I'm doing by working for the same people.
Right.
And I could also make the argument like, hey, if I stopped doing this, if I stopped doing advertising, it isn't like the Walmarts of the world or, you know, the Pfizers of the world are going to not have access to someone who's going to do advertising for them. But then I can also say, well, you know, that's how you have some of the worst atrocities in the world. When someone says, well, if I don't do it, someone else will do it. So why not do it?
Yeah.
But then again, I have been very, you know, on the one hand, I fretted for such a long time, and I still do, about how little of my advertising work has been produced. How little of it? Almost none of it has been produced. So I haven't really helped Walmart's bottom line. I haven't really helped any of the corporations really. I mean, there have certainly been some, AT&T, I know that I helped their sales increase. You know, I've seen the reports. Mm-hmm. I know that that's in a direct relation to the work that me and my team had created at BBDO. And there are things that AT&T has done that I am certainly not psyched about. So I'm left with in a gray area, and I'm confused, and I have conflict about it. I'm conflicted. You said at the very beginning, it's all, you know, in improv, there's a piece of work called a herald, and Del Close, who was one of the founders of long form improv, he would say that life is a slow herald, and a herald is where the piece kind of ends where it began. Not that we have to end right now, but like, it's interesting because you began this whole thing about conflict and being in conflict, contradiction.
Right. Right.
With oneself.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a contradiction, Mike.
Well, as you're describing your dilemma, I wonder, and both reading your bio at the beginning or your about at the beginning and you know, looking at all the various projects, the consulting that you do often with Andrew, would you be able to make the living that you want/need to make doing that and only taking jobs from places that you gave a thumbs up to, in theory?
Well, there's a couple of things in that question. I mean, we're a new consultancy. We've been doing the consultancy of side projects has existed for just a little over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And many businesses are not self-sufficient in their first one or two or three years in many industries, restaurants, advertising, you know, small businesses. So that's not a surprise that we couldn't only support our, you know, our expenses just from side projects. But only working with companies that we give a thumbs up to? No, and nor would I want to. I think there, like I said, with the Virgin work, I think there's an opportunity that if you're going to be brought into a room with decision makers at Walmart, that you can go in with an idea that makes Walmart a better company.
Right.
They probably won't buy that idea, but someone in the room said it, offered it up as an option, created a discussion about it.
Right.
And so I don't think the solution is just to walk away from all the companies, if you're in advertising,
right,
to walk away from all the companies you don't agree with. I think there's an opportunity if you have the right relationships, and sometimes those relationships are not in place given the agency relationship or who you're talking with at the client. But there's always an opportunity to be like, well, instead of making a TV commercial, what if we took our money and did this initiative?
Mm-hmm.
What if we actually changed our business practices so that we have something more interesting to advertise when we do advertise? And sometimes it's just the smallest companies of that scale. I think Ben and Jerry's talked about this in about their own company when a company like McDonald's, you know, there's lots of things about McDonald's I don't like, but when a company like McDonald's changes all their napkins to recyclable paper, the impact that has, given the footprint they have, is enormous.
Yeah.
You know, and they have done that. But they could have also then come out with they're going to do a commercial. They've already bought the media for the year. So they're going to do a commercial. They could do a commercial about how they've done this. So now there's a piece of information out there, this commercial that promotes the brand. And the thing that they've done has improved the world to some small degree. Of course, you could still have a conversation about, well, what about the food and how unhealthy that may or may not be. But hey, you know, like my therapist said, you can only do what you can do, and you can only affect, you know, the changes that you have access to, you know?
Right.
So you can only affect the decisions that you have access to, and you get no access to any of them if you're not in the room.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the reality is the real budgets are from the biggest companies.
Right.
And the bigger the company, just by the nature of being big, you affect more people. And a lot of companies move through the world either unaware or uninterested in the weight that's left behind them in trying to achieve their profits.
So we can say that you can go into these companies or into these relationships with these companies and at least plant a seed, if not more.
At least plant a seed, if not more. And who else, look, advertising is part of the marketing mix and it's part of business. And who else is going to be the one to even raise these thoughts? It's not going to be the accountant. It's not going to be the IT guy. It's not going to be, you know, the business analyst. But the advertising people, because advertising is made up of a lot of people who do have artistic backgrounds, who do spend most of their time thinking about what do people care about? What do people react to emotionally? That's what all the writers and art directors and designers and editors and, you know, filmmakers who are employed within advertising are always thinking about how to do. And so we're the front line between the brand and the actual audience and the consumer and the customers. We're the ones who are kind of putting on the smiling face for brands. We're creating the way they contact the world. So I think it's really incumbent upon all of us in this industry to bring these things up, maybe not all the time, but bring them up where relevant and where the most opportunities are for these discussions to happen in boardrooms. Very often you might be left out of the room, or you might be told, okay, that's really great, but that's not what we're doing now. Right now, this is about Black Friday sales, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue even Black Friday sales is an opportunity. You look at a brand like REI who says, we're going to close. I think it was REI that said they're not going to participate in Black Friday. They don't believe that's what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be out there. You look at a brand like Nordstrom's who, you know, refuses to be open on Christmas or Thanksgiving because they have a value system. Our employees should not be here on those days. While every other brand is saying, okay, on Black Friday, we're going to open the doors early for, you know, doorbuster sales. You know, you can, so there's always an opportunity. You could always say to a brand, hey, instead of doing a Black Friday sale, what if we did the opposite? You know, depending on whether that's in line with what their values are. You know, you have to figure out what does the brand actually really stand for, other than making the hamburger, other than making, you know, the toilet bowl, or rather than making the sneaker. Like, what do they actually stand for other than what they make?
Right. So maybe you can help me in wrapping this up to come up with a good tagline for this episode. I mean, the short version would be Jeff Greenspan, Brooklyn-based artist, activist, and advertiser on art and advertising. Or, you know, that's a repeat, but something like Jeff Greenspan on art and advertising, you know, like a sentence.
That's how you were going to say. I thought it was going to be more like Jeff Greenspan, a constant contradiction.
Yeah. Sure. That works. That works. That's doable.
Yeah.
Jeff. That short. You think it should be that short? Jeff
shorter.
Greenspan.
It should always be shorter. It should just be really one word. Jeff
Greenspan. Right.
Contradiction.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's been great talking to you, man. Thanks.
Thank you so much for the time, man. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thank you very much again to Jeff for talking to me. I really got a lot out of that, even listening back after having been in the moment with him. Listening back again, I got a lot more out of that as well. I hope you guys did as well. Yeah, and if you have any comments, questions, definitely let him or I know. I will pass any questions you might have or comments to Jeff. Of course, you can find him quite readily on social media, as you heard. Thank you guys for being here. I do want to remind you before I get into that Earth story about the Voyager and a few thank yous that this is a listener-supported show. I'm thrilled that we have a sponsor for this episode, but that does not mean we do not still need your support to keep the show going. So financially, you can do that by donating to the show via PayPal, which is linked through theconversationpod.com/support. You can also become a regular supporter on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. Though if you go up to $3 a month or a one-time PayPal donation of $25 or more, you will get bonus episodes. You will get on the mailing list. You will get my undying love. So there's that. Non-financially, you can support the show by leaving a nice review on one of the multiple platforms that we exist on, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, etc. Let other people know that you like the show by word of mouth or online. Of course, you can also follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. You can become a fan on Facebook as well. And speaking of social media, I wanted to thank a few people who have been helping this show, and I really, really appreciate them. Of course, Kate Mitchell, first and foremost, who has been producing this show for a while, mainly helping me select guests for the show, which is instrumental. And thank you to her. I also want to thank Divya GOT, who has been assisting me on Instagram for a couple months now. You may have noticed a marked improvement in some of those posts recently. So big thanks to her. And also to Madison Haley, who has been taking over the reins of Twitter of late. So thanks to all of them. All right, I wanted to share with you something that I found on the Weisslink. There's a lot of salacious material on Weisslink, and at some point I will get back to that. But this one I particularly liked because it is something that came via the data transfer service WeTransfer, which I use quite frequently and for free. So I am grateful for their service, and I thought it would be nice to pay it back a little bit by promoting one of their projects, which is a creative project, and that is A Message from Earth. It features work inspired by the golden record that is contained on the Voyager spacecraft, which has been, as they call it, hurtling away from Earth for the past 40 years. And so I wanted to just give you a little taste of it by going to that webpage. So this is how it starts. A Message from Earth is a celebration of the Voyager golden record in its 40th year. It was a gift sent from our world into deep space for whatever might find it. Dazzled by that audacity, we present new ideas from 40 cultural luminaries inspired by the original. Together, these amazing minds offer a collage of the contemporary human experience. We hope it inspires selfless acts of cultural diplomacy in the years ahead. And then you scroll down, and there's a preface, and then it says, somewhere out there. in deep space, beyond the limits of time itself, is this. And then there's a blinking vintage graphic text design, and it says, a spacecraft called Voyager, one of a twin pair, launched in 1977, destined to be the first human-made object to enter interstellar space. And then another cool graphic. On board this vessel is a golden record. In its grooves lie a representation of humanity created in the event that intelligent life may receive it. And then there's a spinning record. And then there's some dude listening to a vintage multi-track music player. And then there's some googly-eyed dude looking at a record. Curated by a team led by Carl Sagan in 1977, this disc is a vision of our world, our sounds, our science, our images, our music, our thoughts and feelings, our grandest ideas, our greatest achievements, our deepest emotions. And then there are more cool graphics. And I will go on, not today, because you will go to this page and you will look at this art and scroll through yourself. I do want to add, lastly, that this reminded me of a show that I just saw the other week, for those of you in the LA area. It's called Strange Attractors, The Anthology of Interplanetary Folk Art, Volume 1, Life on Earth. It's a show organized by Bob Nickus, well-known freelance curator based in New York, and it's at Redling Fine Art in Hollywood. And I saw that show. It's a hugely packed group show of about 40 artists and like 90-some works. Very impressive, though. Really good show. If you're in LA, highly recommend it. It's open until January 13th, same day that my show opens, and a little bit more about that. I just want to say that, you know, if you're not in LA, I know you want to be there. We will post images on IG, among other places. And I just want to add that you really do need to see these cyanotypes on canvas in person to get a sense of them. Even I don't have a sense of them, because this is going to be the first time this particular body has been installed in such a way that I'll be able to see it outside of my tiny studio. So I'm looking forward to that. Would love to see you guys there. It's Eastside International. It's at the edge of the brewery complex. Look it up. Don't have the address exactly on me. I believe it's Moulton, M-O-U-L-T-O-N is the street. I'll tell you more about it in the next episode. But I'll put a link on the website as well. So hope to see you guys there. I hope you guys have a good holidays. That is it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. And I look forward to talking to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.